And good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also happy to have back on the program once again, Home Inspector Scott Spies. He is on this program once a month. It's always on a Monday, and we do these shows so that you can have this regular chance to ask home maintenance questions. So we got some problem, something needs to be fixed, you're not quite sure how to deal with it, give us a call, tell us about it, and Scott will see if he can help you out. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We have a toll-free line, so it's no charge if it's long distance, 800-222-9455. You can also send us your question by email if you want to do that. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, David. Always a pleasure to come out here and talk to all of our guests.
Well, right away, I have something here that came in actually in advance of the program by email, so I'll go ahead and ask this question for this listener. This person writes, I have six recessed lights on one circuit in my kitchen ceiling. Most of them have burned out once, but one light has burned out five times. Two of those times, the circuit breaker flipped, which the person says was a little scary. As they say that I want to change them from incandescent bulbs to LEDs, but before I make that investment, should I have the circuit checked by an electrician, or do you think I just got a bad batch of bulbs?
No, I think there's probably a problem with the fixture itself. I'm guessing that a loose ground or a loose neutral connection in the box, which means an electrician will need to go up in the attic and probably take the wire nuts off and reconnect them. It's possible we could get anything from condensation. If it's particularly if it's over near a stove or something like that, it's in an attic. It tends to stay a little cooler. You get a little bit of high humidity in the kitchen, boiling water and such. We could actually be getting a short caused by moisture in the fixture. So, yes, it definitely should be checked by an electrician to find out what's going on inside that fixture.
All right, very good. Well, again, that's the one question we had to start, but certainly if other folks have questions, they want to give us a call, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, we get your questions in. So anything in particular at this time of year you think would be good for people to be thinking about?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that. Well, I'll tell you what, the one I get most right now is bugs, ants. We did not have a good hard freeze this year, and by not having a good hard freeze, we didn't kill off a lot of the insects, and so they are already coming out in force. And unfortunately, as a home inspector, I haven't got any good remedies for this, but people are forever calling me, well, I've got bugs coming in here, and mostly ants, spiders, so I'm going to guess that the exterminators are going to be quite busy very shortly. From a home inspector standpoint, the only thing I can do is walk around the outside, look for any open holes, open areas, try and keep leaves, landscaping, etc., raked back away from the foundation so that, if nothing else, the access points where these critters are getting into the house are visible so we know where to spray or where to apply the chemicals to try and keep them out, bait traps, things like that. Keeping things dry around the foundation, downspout extensions. Boy, I hate to bring that up every month, but it does seem to be so pertinent in so many situations. Just the bug situation is going to be, I think, really a problem in the next month or two.
And I think what people find out is that it doesn't take a very big crack or space for ants or some other small insect to get in, and it couldn't indeed be that something that you really would have a hard time, maybe even you would have a hard time walking around looking to find where that spot is.
And what makes it harder is, last year's leaves are still tucked up against the foundation in a couple places, or we've got the landscape gravel or landscape bark up against the bottom of the siding where they can get in behind the siding without you being able to see where they're coming up the foundation. Ideally, the foundation should show about 6 to 8 inches above the final grade, the whatever landscape bark, whatever gravel, grass, whatever. You should see 6 to 8 inches of the concrete foundation between the landscaping and the siding. And this area, if you keep it clear where we can see it and keep it dry, will help reduce the chances of some of the bugs and such getting back into the house.
Yeah, and you certainly want to be careful about soil being up against the side of the house. You don't want to, or probably different kinds of plant material, because you don't want to provide an avenue for insects to get in. You certainly don't want to make a bridge so that if there are any termites around, that they can also find a way in.
Yeah, and also anything you have up against the siding like that can hold moisture next to the siding, mm-hmm. and the siding is attached to wood framing right behind that, right above your concrete foundation. That's where your wood framing starts in this area. Well, we have a few brick houses, but for the most part, I would say that's where the wood framing starts, and keeping that wood framing dry will not only reduce the chances of bugs, but also reduce the chances of damage from mold, mildew, rot, deterioration, things like that.
Yeah. Probably most people have, or even though it's been kind of warm, probably people are not running their air conditioning yet. At what point would you think that people might want to at least turn it on and check it out and see, is it working?
Well, with the mild weather we're having right now, if the heating and cooling guys are not swamped, it's a good time for you to do your check. You know, I usually recommend that you check the air conditioning and furnace systems about every 2 years. And if you haven't done it lately, this is a good time to have them come in. They can still do both a furnace and air conditioner check on the same day, so that you can kill two birds with one stone. They can make sure the furnace is operating properly, and they can double check the air conditioner, make it sure it's ready to go. If you've put a cover or something over the top of the air conditioner, even if you're not ready to turn it back on yet, I would take the cover off about this time of year. We start getting some moisture condensation. We really want to let everything dry out and get some air to it. That way, when you are ready to use it, it's ready to go.
Yeah, that's, I'm sure that over time we have gotten some questions from people wanting to know, well, should they put some kind of a cover over the external unit for their whole house air conditioning and for their central air? And I guess I thought the basic advice was no, because you really don't want, you want to make sure that if there is some moisture that does get in there, that it actually has a chance to get out, and you don't want it trapped.
Yeah, for the most part, the outdoor units are designed to be outdoors, and therefore they are usually set up and designed to where the finishes and such will last for about the life of the unit before we start getting rust and things like that. So usually covering is not necessary. Now, if you're in an area with very high content of brush and leaves and things like that, or tree branch damage, you may want to put a cover on it. But if you cover it, make sure you use a breathable fabric. Mm-hmm. Don't use a plastic cover. Mm-hmm. Something more like a canvas type cover that will allow some air to move in and out and allow the moisture out. You try and wrap that thing up with plastic. I've seen tarps, plastic bags, etc. That just holds that moisture in, and it will actually reduce the life of the outdoor unit rather than extend it.
Yeah, maybe there are people who are thinking about replacing their air conditioning this year, they're thinking about energy efficiency. You know, maybe they have a unit that's been in place there for more than 10 years, and they're kind of thinking about it. How do you make that decision?
Another very valid point, and you already used my qualifier there. Yeah, yes, if you have a unit that is probably in the 10 to 15-year range, it is time to start considering a new unit. The technology in air conditioning has been getting much, much better. The efficiency of the unit's much better. It will save you money to replace the old unit. Air conditioning units are rated in seasonal energy efficiency ratings, or SEER, S-E-E-R. And that SEER number is the actual number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity used. So if you have a unit that is 15 years old and has a SEER rating of 6, it takes 6 watts of electricity to produce one BTU of cooling. You get 6 BTUs of cooling per 1 watt of electricity. So if you have a 15 SEER, which is the newer ones, right now you can't buy anything less than 13, you end up with 13 or 15 BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. So you actually reduce your electrical use in half by switching to one of the newer units. Mm-hmm. And considering that the air conditioner is probably one of your larger electrical uses for the summertime, the idea of possibly taking my electric bill and chopping it in half, It makes an awful lot of sense. So that air conditioning unit, if it's getting a little older, even some of the 8 and 10 units, again, with the new 13 SEER, the new 15 SEER, I saw one the other day that was a 16 SEER. I'm not sure I would replace that if I had a 13 already, but if I've got a 6 or an 8, well, I'd sure be looking at getting one of the higher efficiency units.
Yeah. When you do that, if you already have central air, do they replace more than that part that sits outside, or is it some of the part that's inside also has to be replaced?
Generally, on the high efficiency units, you will need to have a new evaporator coil in the plenum for the furnace as well. They've redesigned how the plenum works, or how the A-coil works, and how efficient it is. So, yes, you will have to do the outside unit as well as the coil inside the furnace unit.
Okay. This morning, we're doing our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's a regular thing that we do to give you the chance to ask questions. And so if there's something that's on your mind, we've been here talking about a couple of things, talking about air conditioning, but whatever it is, you know, could still be about insulation, could be about heating, could be about doors, windows, attics, basements, gutters, windows, whatever. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear it, and that is 800-222-9455, and we do have that email too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. I think the last time you were here, I asked about exterior painting, and we did our usual thing about, well, when does it, at what point is it warm enough so that it's okay to paint outside? And it has a lot to do essentially with what the coldest temperature, what the low is overnight. Are we now at a point now where it's actually warm enough so that you could be doing painting outside? Or would you still say, no, hold off on that?
Actually, if you want to do some scraping and painting and get some paint on there, we can probably trust the weatherman for the next 2 or 3 days. And so far they're saying, hey, it's going to stay above 40 degrees, so you should be in good shape. The biggest thing about exterior painting is moisture. You don't want to paint right after it rained, because if you had any bare exposed wood, that wood is way too moist to hold the paint. The paint can't get a good cure to the wood, and you end up with peeling paint very soon. So I'm more worried, once we get to this time of year, I'm more worried about how dry the wood is that you're actually trying to paint. And it is a very valid point. We've got a lot of the pre-hung doors that are being used nowadays come with a factory prime coat on both the wood trim and on the steel doors. And that factory prime coat has this little tag that says needs to have 2 coats of exterior grade paint applied as soon as possible. I see an awful lot of these doors 4 or 5 years later that still have the factory prime coat on both the door and the trim. So, yeah, you might want to get out there and start thinking about doing a little bit of maintenance on the exterior to help extend the life of some of the trim around the windows and doors.
Okay. Here is another email. Someone writes, in their home, they have switched over to compact fluorescent bulbs in most of their fixtures. However, I've noticed in some places, like our bathroom, the compact fluorescent bulbs are not particularly bright. I know the energy savings with LED bulbs are about the same, so my question is, would I have any issues with bulb brightness from LEDs, and do you think it would be a good idea to upgrade in locations where the lights are dim?
Usually if they're dim, it's with the compact fluorescents, they do have a warm-up time. When you first turn them on, they're a little dim. And in a bathroom, where you're usually not in there for long periods of time, they may not actually fully warm up and come to a full brightness. You can usually get a higher lume or a brighter bulb to put in there. And if you're replacing it with the equivalent of a 60-watt bulb, you might want to try replacing it with the equivalent of a 100-watt bulb. When it comes on, it'll be a little bit brighter. Now, if you're in there for taking a shower and you're in there for 15 minutes, it's going to be pretty bright in there. And most of those compact fluorescents are not intended for areas where you have a dimming switch. So it can be a little bit of a, we'll call it one of the throwbacks of, or one of the drawbacks of the compact fluorescents, is that they are not as like our incandescents, where they're immediately bright. I haven't got a good solution for it. It's in the design of the bulbs. They are making, again, this is a relatively new product. They are making a lot of changes in the technology. The dimmable bulbs are becoming more and more available. If you remember, the compact fluorescent bulbs as little as 3 years ago were $19 a piece. Now you can buy a three-pack for $8 or $9. So the technology is coming around. The practical application of them is getting much more widespread. We're able to put them in a lot more places, a lot more economically. I would say hang in there. They're probably going to get better. For the moment, you might just want to put one a next size larger bulb in there to get the extra light.
Yeah, okay. There doesn't seem to be a really good solution for those places where there are some places where, as you say, you're kind of going in and out. You're turning that on for a little bit and you're turning it off. And then maybe 5 minutes later, you're going to come back. And the fluorescents really don't like that. Then they would just as soon be turned on and left on for long periods of time.
Yeah, like I say, they do take a few minutes to warm up and to come up to full brightness. So if you've got one in an area where you're using it for very short periods of time, it's not going to provide the same amount of illumination as you'd get with an incandescent bulb. They also don't like anything that has a photocell or a dimmer. So the compact fluorescent lights do not work well for your outdoor lights, your pole lights and things like that that are controlled by photocells. I see it all the time where there's one out there. My guess is they're not going to last long. When the photocell doesn't flip on quite as instantaneously as a light switch, and so it kind of gives a low current draw or low current voltage to the bulb itself, and it tends to damage the circuitry that the fluorescent is actually using.
All right. Well, again, other questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone to ask a question off the air, and this is something that we certainly have talked about before. There seems to be more and more, I think, interest in it, and that is the caller would like you to talk a little bit about radon testing and radon abatement.
Okay. Radon gas, colorless, odorless, invisible gas. It's effectively a decomposing rock, generally a granite, and we end up with this very slight radioactive material coming out of it. Radon is everywhere. It comes up out of the ground. It has higher concentrations in some areas than in others. There's no good rhyme or reason without looking underneath the soil as to what you've got for a bedrock or a foundation. As to, you know, a house, one area may have a lot more radon than a house right next door. Since it is a gas coming up out of the ground, it is very proportional to barometric pressure. If we have a low barometric pressure where we have a nice stormy day, overcast, we could have a higher radon content than if we have a bright sunny day, where such as today. If you put in a test for radon, most of the common ones are 2 and 3 day tests. You must remember that those tests are accurate for 2 to 3 days. It is not necessarily a representative of the yearly average that the EPA has based their numbers on. If you get a high reading on a 2 or 3 day test, you should then invest in a long-term test, long-term being 2 to 3 month test. That will give you a much better idea on how your house is related on this radon level versus the yearly average. Right now, the yearly average, which is considered to be an area of concern, is 4 picocuries. I believe the EPA, it's been a while since I read it, but I believe the EPA says if you have a level between 4 and 7 or 4 and 10, that they recommend you do something about it in the next few years. In other words, they're not really panicking about it, but it's probably a good idea. So if you have what we'll call a low-level radon of 4 to 6, 4 to 7, yes, it's something that probably ought to be looked into, but it's not necessarily something that we have to move out of the house and go stay in a motel until it gets taken care of. Mm-hmm. So I'm not big on the panic factor with the radon. The other thing is their numbers, these levels of concern, are based on you being in the house with the windows and doors closed for pretty much 350 days out of the year. So if you're an outgoing person, you get out there, you open the windows and doors, you go to work for 8 hours a day, things like that, their numbers really don't apply to you. Now, granted, there is a number that they threw out there, and the EPA says, hey, 4 is bad. Well, four can be bad if you are bedridden in the lowest level of your house and you never leave. Four is much more of a concern than if you're home 4 or 5 hours a day during the day and then sleep there at night. It's nowhere near as much of an effort or a problem. To mitigate radon, what they usually end up doing, if you've got a crawl space, they put down a very good vapor barrier, a thick plastic seal. They tape it down. They put a fan outside the house. And they put a pipe underneath the plastic. They draw the air from under the plastic and literally just blow it outside, usually above the roof. The requirements are that the exhaust fan from a radon mitigation system should be 2 feet above a roof line or 10 feet away from a wall. So you could actually dig it straight out from the house 10 feet and run a pipe up out of the ground and let it come up out more than 10 feet from the house. This is to prevent air from being drawn back into the house from that radon fan. But that's it. Literally all they do. They're evacuating it and throwing it outside, which means they're not getting rid of the radon gas. It's everywhere. It's outdoors. They're letting it dissipate. It's a little bit more of a problem on houses that are extremely tight because now the radon gas comes in and it doesn't leave the house. So our newer construction houses do end up with a higher radon level. Champaign, Urbana area where we're at, doesn't have what I'll call a real high reading. Yes, we can get readings up to about 15 is about as high as I've seen. More commonly, we have them between 2 and 6 or 2 and 7. You get out into the Pennsylvania areas where they can have readings of 200. You get up in the Dakotas where we can have readings of 300. Those are areas where the radon is something to be very concerned about. So I have a hard time getting all panicky about what we've got here in town. Yes, it is something that you should look at, particularly if you've got somebody that's staying home all the time. They're inexpensive tests. They're not hard to do. The three-day tests are usually you hire somebody, they'll come in there and they'll put in a machine. The long-term tests are usually the least expensive, a little charcoal canister that you can pick up, put in the low level of your house, forget about it for 3 months. At the end of 3 months, you put a piece of tape over the charcoal canister, put it in a packet, and mail it off to a lab, and they will give you an assessment of what the radon level is. So that's pretty much my take on it. It's something that should be looked into, but it's not something that you need to panic about, in my opinion.
Okay. If that caller wants to follow up or anybody else does, you can call us. And certainly other questions, welcome too. Have somebody here ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And here is a caller in Urbana, line number one.
Hi. Yes. I asked my question with apologies because I think you were just finishing the topic when I tuned in. But I live in an Urbana house that has a north porch that has a railing that has been painted off and on, not for 3 years or so. But anyway, it's a dampish side of the house, I'm deciding, because the paint has a way of peeling from the railings. And I'm just wondering, is this a time of year when one can, not just the time of year, but a miraculous spring where the temperature is such that one could do something about the peeling paint on the north porch with special paint or special prep, or is it just too damp now or too iffy?
Well, the weather we have around here does have a lot of moisture and a lot of humidity, so you are going to have to pick days where we haven't had rain for a couple of days. We've had some good sunshine. I don't know if the right away early spring where we've still got a lot of moisture in the soil is going to be helpful. You may want to wait just a little bit longer until we've had a few more warm days to kind of dry things out. I guess I've got two questions on the paint peeling. When paint peels, there are usually two very distinctive types of peeling. One type of peeling is where it comes off in, I'll say, large pieces of irregular shapes,
just that's my type.
Flakes of paint. Okay.
Usually
flakes of paint are one or two things. Either the surface was not prepped properly, or we have too much moisture in the wood that you're trying to paint.
Yeah. It's an old house, so okay. I don't know what that has to do with it. But
it has a lot to do with
1938.
If you have exposed wood, if you're trying to paint overexposed wood, the paint can stick to the wood cells that are slightly oxidized. The sunlight has damaged them. So before you put on a paint, what I would recommend is scrape off as much of the loose paint as you can, then do a real quick light sanding.
Yes.
to remove any of the dead wood, basically give you a fresh wood surface to adhere the new paint to. Get a decent primer to put on there to help adhere to the wood. The primer will tend to leach into or soak into the wood a little bit better.
Right.
Paint tends to stand on the surface, and so therefore it has a hard time adhering. But you put a primer which soaks down into it a little bit better, and then the paint can adhere to the primer. It's got kind of a rough texture to it, and it's a little tacky, so it'll hold that paint better.
Is there a brand or a type? Or I don't know my paints. I'm very ignorant.
Well, I'm not going to get into the chemical makeup on the paints
I was thinking the primer, any special brand or anything?
No, most of the primers are good for mostly exterior primers. You'll have to look to make sure it's an exterior, not an interior. You should be fine. One of the problems is the chemicals made for the paint. In order for the paint to really work well, we have to use some chemicals that are being shunned. So they're trying to make paint out of newer chemicals, and they don't seem to cover as well. The pigment doesn't hold as well. They don't seem to adhere as well. They don't seem to repel moisture or mold and mildew as well.
Right.
So, I would stick with one of the top quality paints. Don't try and buy the inexpensive paint.
Right. Good. Well, I appreciate your help.
A good prep on the wood. It'll make a big difference.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much.
All right, very good. Yeah. Thank you. That is, of course, the key. I think that's really the hardest work. The surface preparation is really the hard work. Painting, maybe not so much so. I mean, you got to be careful to get good coverage and it be smooth and all that kind of stuff. But if you don't do the good surface preparation, then who knows how long that paint's going to stay on there.
And I suppose, as I did mention, there are two different types of peeling. I ought to come up with the other one.
Oh, yeah.
other than the irregular flakes or irregular-sized flakes, there is also a perpendicular cracking, perpendicular to the wood grain of the lumber. If you get a lot of, and I mean a lot of, cracks going out the opposite direction or the perpendicular direction to the wood grain, that usually means you've got too many layers of paint. And no matter what you do, until you scrape all that old paint off, it's not going to stick. It's going to keep cracking. Because paint, when it's in a thin film, one or two coats, has a fairly good elasticity. It will stretch. When the wood expands and contracts with temperature and humidity changes, the paint will stretch with it. Once that paint gets to about 25 thousandths of an inch, and we get 10 or 15 coats on there over the years, 1938 house, as she was indicating, the paint no longer wants to stretch. So when the wood expands and contracts, it actually cracks and breaks the film, and we end up with a cracking that it looks like somebody just drew a bunch of lines up and down the lumber. And that type of paint peeling will need to be scraped all the way down to the bare wood before applying new paint, or it's not going to stick well.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of focus is Scott Spies, and we're taking your questions on home maintenance. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL invites you to meet Alan J.W. Bell, director and producer of England's longest-running television comedy, Last of the Summer Wine. Alan is a great teller of tales. Don't miss his behind-the-scenes stories and video. Join us at Campbell Hall on Friday, March 23rd at 5:30 p.m. A $50 per person donation is requested. To make a pledge and receive admission as your thank you, phone 217-244-9455.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, with 10 different topics every week. Most of the shows this week actually will be archives. We are doing a live program on Wednesday morning, the morning after the Illinois primary, to try to talk a little bit about the results. Jamie Dunn will be with us, State House Bureau Chief at Illinois Issues Magazine, and also John Jackson. He's a visiting professor at the Paul Simon Institute down at Southern Illinois University. Otherwise, the shows will be archives, and in the second hour today, you will hear a rebroadcast of a program that we first did in January. We were talking with Michael Erard. He's a senior researcher at the Frameworks Institute. He's written a very interesting book entitled Babel No More, which takes a look at his effort to find the world's most extraordinary language learners. Most people in their life learn a language. Some people learn a couple. There have been stories, however, over time of people who could speak 10, 15, 20 more languages. And the question is, well, is that really possible? And is there anyone today that could make that claim. That's what the book is about, and that's what our conversation is about, and you can hear that in hour number two. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. That way you can also listen to past programs. You can also find us on Twitter at Will Public Media. We're also on Facebook. This morning, in this hour, Scott Spies is here. He's with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always a Monday, and we talk about home maintenance. So if you have a problem, could be gutters, attics, windows, doors, siding, insulation, heating, cooling, any and all of that, any and all the pieces and parts of the single-family home, you give us a call. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line, the good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And we also have an email. You can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And here we have someone who writes in that he's having a problem, or at least he says it looks like algae stains and roof mold seems to be becoming an issue in central Illinois. If it starts to stain the shingles, what is the best treatment?
Okay, well, most of the staining that we get in this area is kind of a black streak that kind of comes down the roofing, and that's actually part of the minerals that they put on there, the mineral granules that they put on the shingles for UV protection. Not usually a problem. It's kind of a cosmetic issue. It is not an indication that the shingles are wearing prematurely, not an indication that we're going to have any significant problems or reduced wear life. But it is a cosmetic issue. Most of it has to do with some type of microorganism growing on the roof and that the mineral is helping to promote it. They make a product called a shingle saver, which is basically either a copper or zinc strip that you can put up at the top up by the cap shingles. And then when it rains, we get just enough acidity in our rain around here to draw the zinc or the copper down the roof, and it will help kill off the algae or kill off the whatever little growth it is. Like I say, it's strictly a cosmetic issue. It's not something that's shortening the life of the roof, and I'm referring to the black streaks. Now, if you happen to have a very well-shaded area and you've got a lot of dirt up there and you're starting to get some actual green moss and such, then there are some algicides that can be sprayed on there to help kill those off, or a little bit of bleach. A little bit of water and bleach mix, but you do have to be careful and use it as a spray bottle or something rather than applying it real liberally, because we don't want the bleach to run down the gutters and come out the downspouts and kill the lawn at the end of the downspouts. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to put so much up there that it runs out into the gutters. But there's a couple of ways of killing it off as well.
Okay.
Like I say, unless you've really got a lot of mossy type growth up there, it's not affecting the life of the shingles.
Okay. Are there any shingles that have anything like that built into them?
They do have several types of algicides and chemicals designed into the shingles to help reduce that. But once again, technology on these things has been changing. You make a shingle and you don't find out it creates this problem until 6 or 7 years later down the road. So you make a change, but that means you've got 7 years of product out there that aren't performing up to your expectations. So it's hard to get it. Most of the time, if you put new shingles on there, we're not going to have that problem because they've already addressed it. They've already figured out, hey, this mineral is one of the ones we're not going to use as a coating or topping on our shingles because of this problem. So it's the older houses we get that have most of the streaking, not usually the newer ones. And I hate to say you have to live with it, but it's usually not as much of a problem as what it appears to be.
Okay. We have a caller in Muhammad. Let's talk with them. Line one.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Can you just give me any kind of suggestions on floor covering for basements that are wet?
Well, no. Because any floor covering you put on in a basement that gets wet is going to hold moisture and it's going to create mold and mildew problems. Obviously, the first thing we want to do is try and dry the basement out. There's different types of paint you can put down, but you don't want to put any carpeting. We don't want to put any hardwood floor. We don't want to put any laminate flooring. Anything like that over the top of the concrete is actually going to hold any moisture when you get some moisture down in the basement. You can get some specific concrete paints that if you basically etch or clean the concrete. We can get a paint to stick down to it. And if you look in some of the garage flooring coverings, they're a polymer or epoxy finish. They actually have some decorative colors so that, you know, rather than put down just a gray porch paint or gray concrete paint, you can actually put some patterns or some designs or colors in your basement floor in a paint that will stick even though we get a little bit of water down there. But as far as floor coverings, nothing that's going to take care of the moisture. We need to get rid of the moisture first.
Okay, so your best suggestion from what I'm hearing is like a garage floor paint or related.
Yeah, they make some epoxy, some 1- and 2-part chemicals that they will put down on a garage floor. They'll have you use a very caustic cleaner to clean the concrete, get all the dirt and stuff out of it, mm-hmm. and then they put down this 2-part epoxy, and it puts a really nice shiny film, or you can get it in just about any different texture you want. They make some flakes that you can spread out there and put some, you know, blue and red speckles in it. If you look into some garage flooring coverings, that type of stuff will work well for basement. So it can make your basement look brighter and cheerier and still hold up to the moisture problems.
Okay, great.
All right, thank you very much. I would think that you just want to make sure if you were doing that you had really good ventilation while you were doing it. I'm not sure I'd want to be cooped up in any closed space with an epoxy that I was painting it on the floor.
Again, most of the stuff they're using these days is not as much of a problem as it used to be. It doesn't outgas as much harmful chemicals as what something, say, 15 years ago did. That's part of what our technology has done is said, hey, we can't use these because of that type of issue. So it's getting better. Good concern, but not as prevalent today as it would have been, say, 15 years ago.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Let's go to Champaign County for somebody else here. Line number 2. Hello.
Hi, I have a concrete question.
Yes.
My mother wants to put about a 2 or 3 inches slab on top of an existing slab where she thinks water might be seeping in. I have never been there during a real rain, so I've been diverting the water away from her house, but so I'm just wondering, what do I do to pour like a slab on top of a slab? I was thinking of drilling some holes in and putting some rebar and scrap metal, and maybe should I etch the surface, or what do you think?
Etching, bonding the concrete is not usually an issue. The problem is that even because you're pouring a thinner layer over the top of one, the thin layer can break up. Even if it were to bond properly, it's down at a different time, it's cured at a different time. They don't, there's a little no cohesion there. The only thing I can suggest on something like that is to make sure that the concrete surface is clean, make sure you've got some type of mesh, and pour the new concrete as thick as you can get by with. 2 inches is minimum. Anything more than that will probably hold up well. Anything less than that will probably crack. Because there is once the existing concrete is set up, there is no good way to bond to it.
Hmm. Well, maybe I should not try to bond to it. Should I put down fiberglass fabric or something and sort of let it float on top? Or does that make any sense? Would that crack?
Well, the problem is the new concrete, the thickness of the concrete is going to determine how strong it is. So it all depends on how much concrete you're putting down. If you try and put down a 1/2 inch of concrete, it's not going to last. If you put down 4 inches of concrete, you're not going to have a problem.
Looks like we're at about 3.5. Should I try to get some kind of more special concrete or add one of these strengthening additives, or what do you think about that?
I would use a reinforced concrete because you are going over it as a second layer. If you're going to get 3 inches of concrete, you should not have any problems at all. Unless you're driving trucks across it, 3 inches of concrete should be fine. Anything more than 2 inches, usually you're in pretty good shape. Anything less than 2 inches, I would say doesn't last as long. So try and pour it as – if you're going to pour less than 2 inches, probably you're going to be better off breaking up the old concrete and starting over.
We're not. So
okay, so if you're going to do more than 2 inches, you should be okay. But definitely use a reinforcement. A lot of times they'll throw the fiberglass in a chopped fiberglass in the concrete and to make it stronger.
When you say reinforcement, you mean a special concrete. You don't mean rebar, which I was already thinking of getting some metal in there.
You could put some metal in, but the concrete itself is a reinforced concrete. They have the fibers mixed in with the concrete. Basically a fiberglass hair that they put in there that makes it a lot stronger.
All right.
All right, very good. Back to Muhammad here, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Uh-huh. I have a 36-year-old house. It has rough-hewn cedar siding, and we've been staining it through the years. And I talked with a painter, and I was thinking of two coats of opaque stain. But he's talking about an exterior paint, putting two coats of exterior paint on it. Should it be primed first?
Okay. Paint, no. Stain, yes. if your painter is trying to put paint over the top of your siding, I do not agree with that whatsoever.
Okay.
Stick with your stain. Putting your opaque stain on there is the best thing for it. Cedar siding has a lot of natural oils in it. If you put a paint on there, which basically is a surface coat, a surface film, it is not going to bond or adhere to the cedar siding. The stain actually penetrates or soaks back into the wood just a little bit, and it will last longer. Now, granted, a stain doesn't last as long as a paint. When you stain a house, you're good for, with a transparent stain, probably 5 to 7 years. With an opaque stain, probably 7 to 12 years.
Okay.
But because you have your cedar siding, I would not put a paint over the top of that cedar siding. It's got to be a stain.
Okay, so two coats of a stain then?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and nothing about priming or anything.
You shouldn't need to do that at this point in time.
Some of the siding is getting kind of pulling away from the board itself, and it's getting kind of soft, so I don't know.
If you've got some damaged or soft siding, that may need to be replaced first. But as far as the cedar goes, usually you don't put a sealer. Well, you don't put a primer. You can use a sealer, but usually not a primer on a cedar siding. And once it's that old, then, yeah, just make sure it's really good and clean before they stain it. Clean and dry before they stain it, and that should get you your maximum life out of your stain.
Now, why would he want to put paint on it?
I can only guess that the painter is not familiar with cedar siding. A paint on cedar siding is asking for problems later down the road. Later down the road, I'm talking 15 or 20 years. Once you start putting a film over the top of the siding, a paint film, it doesn't adhere well, so it tends to peel well easily. Because of the rough texture, it tends to go on very thick. Once we start getting a thick base, it wants to crack as the cedar expands and contracts with temperature changes, with seasonal movement. The cedar is soft enough there's no good way to sand or scrape back down to bare wood.
Okay.
So, like I say, putting paint on cedar just is, you're asking for a problem, and my guess is you're going to take a nice siding and make it into something that's going to need replacement in 20 years.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right, very good. We'll go on to another caller here, Sullivan, line four. Hello.
Yes. Just talking about concrete 2 inches or more over existing concrete, does that also hold where it's warm weather, where it does not freeze?
If you're not freezing, it's better, but the thickness of the concrete is the strength of the concrete.
Okay.
And so it's one of those deals where the thinner it is, the more likely it is to break. Granted, when it's warmer and we don't have the freeze-thaw, the concrete tends to last a lot longer. We don't get the moisture getting into it and then expanding and lifting off. So there's less breakage. But still, 2 inches is about the minimum I'd want to see anybody pour anything and get it to last.
Or if you put fiberglass in the concrete, does it? The fiberglass come up so, you know, I get you bare feet or anything like that?
Usually not, because when they trowel it down, the fines in the concrete float to the surface, and they should cover all that.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. We have time, certainly, for a number of other questions. This is our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is the guest. He's with the Home Inspection, Spies Home Inspection Service. We've been doing this for quite a long time here on a regular basis, so that if you have some home maintenance problem and you need to get some advice, you can give us a call. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's somebody in Leroy, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I was calling about the cedar siding.
Yeah.
Yes.
We put it on in 83, and then we started the transparent oil-based Olympic, and then we went to the solid colors, and we had to paint every 5 to 7 years. The last time they do not make an oil-based stain from Olympic. It's not allowed in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried about 5 years ago. We went with the latex stain over the oil, okay. And that does not last. So I didn't know if there's any. We tried priming it, and then we tried part of the house. We tried priming it, and then we put latex stain from Olympic on it, and hopefully it's just only been on for a year. So I didn't know if the rest of the house, if you had any other ideas what we could do.
So you've got you've got an oil base over the top of it, and you're trying to put a latex over it. Yeah, it's hard to find a good oil these days.
Yeah, they don't make it. Well, they say it's illegal in Illinois to have an oil-based stain.
Yeah, they're taking all the good stuff away from us.
So my idea is, or I guess my question is, what do we do now?
And unfortunately, I haven't done enough research to be able to come up with a real good answer for you.
Okay.
Have you worked with Olympic? You've called them up and explained what the issue is, and have they given you any suggestions and help on that?
Yeah, you just cannot buy it in Illinois. I don't know. They said, I talked to one guy, he said maybe you ran to Missouri. But the lady I heard just on a little while ago, you were talking about putting paint on. Yeah, that does not work on cedar siding.
It does. It makes the siding have a finite life. Cedar siding can last for generations, but once you've painted it, now all of a sudden the paint sticks on there and it's going to get ugly quick and you're not going to be able to sand it down, and so you end up covering it with something else. So paint will work for a short period of time. You know, if you're going to burn the house down in 20 years, then go ahead and paint it.
Okay.
But if you plan on keeping it for any length of time, I would stay away from the paint. But we are running into this where we're getting, you know, we're trying to be so protective of our environment, and which rightfully so, but we're changing the products that we're putting onto the houses, what used to last. Hey, a lead-based paint never had mold and mildew in it. Granted, if you eat the paint chips, it's not good for you. But we didn't have mold and mildew on the paint. You know, we didn't have any staining, and it covered in one coat. So, yeah, I understand that there are problems with it, and it is hard to get. Once you've got an oil base, you can put latex over oil, and it will, I'll call it work, but it's a little tougher.
It peels.
Yeah, and definitely you can't go the other way. You can't put oil over the top of the latex. So once you put latex on, you can't go back to an oil.
Okay, well, I'm just saying the latex Olympic does not stick long to the oil. If it already has oil on it, it will not stick more than 4 or 5 years.
And you've done a pretty good prep coat where you cleaned it really well.
Spray painted it and spray washed it, and then put bleach mix on to kill mold because it doesn't have the mold inhibitor, like you said. So we took it down and tried to clean it as best we could, and we tried to latex over it, and that just doesn't.
Are you applying that with a roller, brush, or a spray?
A brush.
Okay.
And we brushed it on, and it lasted about 5 years, and now we're redoing it again. So my question was, I didn't know if you had any advice or what we...
Yeah, unfortunately, at the moment, I don't think I can fix that one.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your input.
Let's go to somebody else here. This is Urbana in line number two. Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about my stucco exterior siding. Little cracks and fissures are forming. Am I going to run into a problem if I'm using a touch of mortar here and there to sort of go over that with a little paintbrush, make it look like stucco, and then paint over it? Is that going to be an issue for me?
Well, first I got to ask, how old is it?
Oh, I'm going to guess, 80 years old at least.
All right, good. You've got stucco. There are some products out there that resemble stucco that are not actually stucco that we do have some issues with. You actually have a stucco, which is a concrete mix. So, yes, putting some mortar in to repair the cracks is a perfectly acceptable repair.
Awesome. Cool.
So, yeah, you should be able to put that on there and get it cleaned up and get a coat of paint on it, and it should blend very well.
And would I be good to actually caulk some of the fissures before I apply my mortar over it, or mortar itself will sort of form the barrier that I'm looking for in terms of water penetration?
If you put the caulk in, make sure you leave enough of a gap. You can get a fairly thick coat of your mortar back on there. Again, if you put just a very thin mortar on there, it has little or no strength.
Right.
So don't fill the crack and then try and just cover it with the mortar.
Right.
If it's a really big crack and you feel that you need to get some weathering in there, then you can put a little bit of caulk in the back of it and then put your mortar over the top of it, yes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Very good. On again to Muhammad, line three. Hello.
Yes. My question is gutters. I have steel gutters, and I have some leaking in the crevices, and they now have an instant... They have an instant can you can buy at Menards that said it stops leaks instantly, and then I bought a tape that also says it seals leaks. So which is the best to use?
I'm going to have to say I don't like either one.
Oh.
The spray can, it does seal leaks instantly. However, it is not does not have the UV protection, and it sunlight tends to burn it up, and I've seen it applied and create problems and start peeling in as little as 3 to 4 weeks. So it seals instantly when you spray it, but they don't tell you how long it's going to last. The best thing to use for gutter seams on steel gutters is a butyl caulk.
Butyl. I've tried that, and the problem with it is it never dries.
You're right. It doesn't. It stays soft and flexible, so when the steel expands and contracts, the caulk can flex with it. You don't want something that gets hard and firm, because steel, when it sun hits it, it gets bigger. When it cools down at night, it gets smaller. It's got to be able to flex, and your steel gutters have to move, so you need something to move with it.
Okay, is that the butyl rubber or just the butyl?
You can get I believe it's a rubberized butyl caulk or just a straight butyl caulk, and both of them will work for that application.
Okay, thanks so much.
You just have to do a little bit of cleaning before you apply it.
All right, thank you.
A little bit of cleaning?
Yeah, you want to make sure that we don't have too much dust or rust where you're trying to seal the joints.
Well, there is rust there that I can't do much about.
A little steel wool. Scotch-Brite pad.
Okay.
All right. We will have to leave it for this time around with our promise that Scott will be back again next month. This is something that we do once a month. It's always on a Monday with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. Thank you very much.
Hey, and I feel I'm special that I wasn't in an archive today.
Only for you.
All right. Thank you very much, David.